The book was called Wittgenstein in Exile, and one of the things that was important to me in writing the book was coming up with a way to see Wittgenstein, sort of come up with some kind of perspective that would help people to figure out what he was up to. And one of the books that preceded mine that was especially famous was Ray Monk's biography of Wittgenstein called The Duty of Genius, and Monk thought it would help people to see Wittgenstein as a genius, and that was a kind of organizing principle for his book. And I took as a sort of organizing principle for my book the idea that Wittgenstein was a sort of exile, and although he geographically moved around a lot, and so he may well classify as an or qualify as an exile in a geographical sense, I drew on a more historical or cultural sense in which I thought Wittgenstein was an exile, in the sense that he identified with an earlier cultural era, at least as Spengler understood these eras. And I think this was a way to sort of make sense of the fact that Wittgenstein felt very, very alienated from people around him and alienated from the culture, or really what he called a civilization that he was a part of. And I think this was closely connected with Wittgenstein's sense that he expressed over and over again in his life that he would not be understood. And I start the book by saying that the fact that Wittgenstein claimed over and over that he would not be understood was a very important fact about Wittgenstein and a fact about interpreters of Wittgenstein that has been completely ignored. Everyone who studies Wittgenstein wants to explain him and help us to understand him. And since Wittgenstein insisted all along that no one would understand him, it was surprising to me that no one took that seriously and tried to sort of diagnose and come up with some sort of perspective on the people's difficulty understanding Wittgenstein, and most importantly, Wittgenstein's sense that people would not understand him. So exile for me was a kind of metaphor, you might say, for helping to get a perspective on Wittgenstein. And when Alois invited me here to give lectures, he said I could draw on the book if I wanted to. And so I have in this talk drawn some on the book, but I have come up with another pair of perspectives on Wittgenstein that I think they're not at all inconsistent with the idea that he's in exile, but I think that they present yet a different perspective. And so the title of my talk is Wittgenstein, Esotericist or Evangelist. And probably you haven't heard Wittgenstein characterized in either of these ways ever before. So I feel like there's something original in my having called him an exile, an esotericist, and an evangelist, and maybe I'm the first person to use that terminology. So I hope I'm providing some new perspectives on Wittgenstein. What I want to say in the talk today that's new beyond what's in my book is kind of conjectural on my part, and so I think there's still research to be done along these lines, so I don't present my work today as some finished project, but rather as an idea of a direction that I want to go in and that I think it would be useful for people to think about as they work on Wittgenstein. So with that, I'll kind of follow along with my script here. And anyway, whom was Wittgenstein addressing in his work? What was he trying to accomplish? And how did he try to accomplish it? These questions ask more than I can answer here, but they give you a sense of what I'm trying to accomplish. So I'm sort of stepping back from dealing with the nitty-gritty of Wittgenstein's views and trying to look at who he was addressing when he was writing this stuff and how he was trying to go about that to try to connect with his audience. So I want to talk about what Wittgenstein was up to and also how this might have changed over time, as I think it did. The terms esotericist and evangelist have not generally been used in characterizing Wittgenstein, but by using them, I also want to place this discussion in a broader context that draws on a wider range of authors and audiences. So I want to talk some about esotericism, what that word means, and how it might apply to Wittgenstein, and the term evangelism, and what that means, and how it might apply. And I apologize for not speaking in Norwegian. I did, however, look up using Google Translator, which Kathy and I have found to be very helpful already. For example, for the washing machine, you know, if you have the directions, you can just put them in the Google Translator. Anyway, it turns out that esoteric doesn't have a Norwegian equivalent, or maybe I should say that is Norwegian, and evangelist is Norwegian too, so there wasn't any alternate wording to offer you. Anyway, the English word, and I guess the Norwegian word esoteric, comes directly from the Greek word esoterikos, which means belonging to an inner circle. And by the way, I mentioned Greek here. I am going to talk some about Socrates today. And tomorrow when I talk about Socrates, I'm also going to be talking about Wittgenstein. So I think both of these talks would be interesting to people in ancient philosophy as well as modern philosophy. But an early use of the term esoteric applied it to the Pythagorean cult of the 5th century in ancient Greece. So you probably have heard of Pythagoras, the mathematician who lived from 570 to 495 BCE, who held certain metaphysical beliefs about the soul, and he withheld these beliefs from the public. So you could find out about Pythagoras' beliefs only by joining his circle. This wasn't something that was shared with the general public. And some few scholars, I guess they go under the term the Tübingen school, have interpreted Plato as being a sort of esoteric philosopher also, holding that Plato wrote his dialogues for the general public. This was his exoteric writings, but that Plato withheld his own views for his school. These were his esoteric beliefs shared only with a limited group of followers, perhaps just members of the academy, and he shared them only orally, supposedly, because he didn't trust written versions of things. So you find out a little bit about this in the Phaedrus and also in the seventh letter. There are some indications, or at least some people take it this way, that Plato had his own views, which he only shared orally and with a special group. This distinction between exoteric and esoteric is employed by Aristotle when he alludes to his exoteric writings. There are two passages specifically and a third approximately in the Nicomachean Ethics in which Aristotle refers to the writings for the general public, or the term he uses, exoterica. And and these may be Aristotle's legendary lost dialogues. Supposedly Aristotle wrote dialogues too, although they haven't come down to us like Plato's did. But Aristotle's dialogues might be what he was referring to here as exoteric. What's interesting about Aristotle's allusions is that they imply that what we are reading of Aristotle is in fact his esoteric writings, the writings meant for a special group. And this fits with the requirement which he sets out early in the Nicomachean Ethics, that his teachings are meant for those who accord with reason in forming their desires and in their actions. If you think about the opening book of Nicomachean Ethics, where Aristotle talks about who he's addressing and what kind of students are the best kind of students for his lectures, this is what he says. He specifically declines to instruct the youth, whether young in age or in experience, who lacks experience of actions in life and tends to follow his feelings and gets no benefit from his knowledge. And near the end of the Nicomachean Ethics, he returns to this theme when he emphasizes that the soul of the student needs to have been prepared by habits of enjoying and hating finely, like ground that is nourished, that is to nourish seed. So Aristotle says in a few places in the Nicomachean Ethics that these writings, or really these lectures, they probably were, are meant for people who have a certain mindset already. They're not meant for just anybody. And his articulation of this point in terms of the proper students for his work supports the theory that what we are reading in the Nicomachean Ethics are either are or are close to lecture notes that Aristotle had for the lectures that he gave in his Lyceum, in his school for students. So there's a little orientation to esoteric and exoteric in ancient Greek philosophy. Similar issues about audience arise in the sayings of Jesus and the gospel writings that recount his life. Jesus regularly taught by telling parables. But concerning the parable of the sower, for example, he's asked by his disciples, what did you mean by this story? And in Luke, in the Gospel of Luke, it says, his disciples asked Jesus what this parable meant, and he answered, "The knowledge of the secrets of the kingdom of God has been given to you, but to the rest it comes by means of parables, so that they may look but not see, and listen but not understand." Now I find that passage very puzzling, because it sounds as though Jesus was purposely trying to confuse the public. But anyway, the distinction he's drawing there is between what he shares with the public and what he tells to his disciples. And that's, again, the esoteric sort of distinction. This idea that Jesus had a secret message is actually reinforced by the discovery in 1945 at Nag Hammadi in Egypt of ancient, very ancient manuscripts of writings about Jesus that describe, and here's the opening sentence of the so-called Gospel of Thomas, that describes the secret words which Jesus spoke. This and other recently discovered writings have come to be called the Gnostic Gospels, and it provided fragments of views of Jesus rather different, sometimes surprisingly so, from the picture found in the four canonical Gospels of the Christian Bible. So the idea of an esoteric message seems to be connected with the notion that certain things should or can only be shared with certain people who are especially deserving or able to appreciate the message that's being conveyed. The clearest illustration of this is Aristotle's lectures, meant for the non-youth whose habits and emotions have been trained to be able to use reason in forming his desires and his actions. Only he, that is, the well-trained student, will benefit from, that is, be able to use the knowledge that Aristotle is providing in his lectures for, as Aristotle says, the end is action, not knowledge. So Aristotle doesn't want to just talk to people and have them hear what he says. He wants to talk to people whose mindset is open to making use of the knowledge that he's giving them in the right way. And so in that sense, we could say that Aristotle's writings were esoteric, meant for a certain well-defined audience, not meant for just anybody. Okay, that's all background now to what I want to talk about concerning Wittgenstein. The clearest indication that Wittgenstein was an esotericist comes in a draft of Zu einem Vorwort, towards a foreword written in November of 1930, and this is in Culture and Value that Alois helped to edit. Wittgenstein says, this book is written for those who are in sympathy with the spirit in which it is written. This spirit is, I believe, different from that of the prevailing European and American civilization. The spirit of this civilization, the expression of which is the industry, architecture, music of the present day, fascism, and socialism, is a spirit that is alien and uncongenial to the author. He says this is not a value judgment. But he is distinguishing himself from, you know, his surroundings, the surrounding civilization. Important parts of Wittgenstein's thoughts here are connected with his views derived from Oswald Spengler about the difference between culture and civilization. And I'm not going to get into that here, but I talk about it a fair bit in chapters 2 and 6 of my book. Anyway, Wittgenstein continues in this draft of a foreword, "Even if it is clear to me, then, that the disappearance of a culture does not signify the disappearance of human value, but simply of certain means of expressing this value, still, the fact remains that I contemplate the current European civilization without sympathy, without understanding its aims, if any. So, he says, I am really writing for friends who are scattered throughout the corners of the globe." He goes on, "It is all one to me whether the typical Western scientist understands or appreciates my work, since in any case he doesn't understand the spirit in which I write. So I am aiming at something different than are the scientists, and my thoughts move differently than do theirs." And then Wittgenstein later comments about the friends that he's addressing. About 2 months later, still in Culture and Value. He says, "If I say that my book is meant for only a small circle," and in German he uses the phrase Kleinkreis, "only a small circle of people, if it can be called a circle, I do not mean to say that this circle is, in my view, the elite of mankind, but it is a circle to which I turn because They form my cultural circle, as it were my fellow countrymen, in contrast to the others who are foreign to me. Who were among the small circle of friends Wittgenstein had in mind? Likely, he was thinking of friends in Olomouc during the Great War, Paul Engelmann, Heini Groag, Fritz and Max Zweig. These were people that he talked with as he was developing this Tractatus when he was training to be an officer in the rear, behind the lines. And in fact, when Paul Engelmann, one of this circle, when Engelmann himself was describing the friends in Olomouc in 1916, he described the group precisely as a Klein in Christ. So Engelmann used the same term about these friends as Wittgenstein uses in his reference to who he's meaning to address. But in addition to that group, perhaps also people like Moritz Schlick, Adolf Loos, Karl Kraus, and Wittgenstein's sister Hermina in Vienna. And among more current friends, perhaps Piero Sraffa and Nicholas Buxton in England. These were people that Wittgenstein talked with and obviously engaged with about philosophical issues. These were people he considered to be friends, peers, and sympathetic to him in some sense. While they were not scattered around the four corners of the globe, they were at least scattered around the corners of Europe. Now, in contrast, when Wittgenstein speaks of the typical Western scientist, I think he has in mind a certain spirit that he imagines the prevailing European and American civilization to hold, what we might call sort of scientism, overvaluing the role and importance of science in society. So Wittgenstein sees himself in the early 1930s as writing for a select group of people who would share with him a certain spirit that he imagines most people would not share. This shared spirit would allow them to understand him, unlike the general public who would not. He concludes with a reflection on the foreword. The danger in a long foreword is that the spirit of the book has to be evident in the book itself and cannot be described. For if a book has been written for only a few readers, that will be clear just from the fact that only a few understand it. Wittgenstein insisted famously over and over that his work would not be generally understood, and this, I think, makes him an esotericist. So I'm drawing on this foreword that he drafted in 1930, describing who he took to be his audience, and I'm using that to position him along with some of the figures from, or some of the interpretations, you might say, of Plato and Aristotle and also of Jesus as being an esotericist. This esotericism of Wittgenstein did not just take hold in the early 1930s, though. His Tractatus was prefaced with similar thoughts. So in the preface to the Tractatus, he says, perhaps this book will be understood only by someone who has himself already had the thoughts that are expressed in it, or at least similar thoughts. So it is not a textbook. You know, it's not meant for the general public. Its purpose would be achieved if it gave pleasure to one person who read or understood it. And the sheer difficulty of understanding the Tractatus makes it natural to suppose that there was some esoteric intent. A book on the Tractatus, written by Alexander Maslow, called A Study in Wittgenstein's Tractatus, it was written by Maslow in 1933, so very early on, but not published until 1961. Maslow's introduction includes the following warning. Maslow says, the Tractatus is, in many of its passages, so obscure that it would be impossible, I believe, to gather the fundamentals of Wittgenstein's view without some help from people who have been initiated into it directly by the author himself. That's an interpretation of Wittgenstein as being an esotericist. That's, you might say, the essence of esotericism. This need for special insight of a different sort was asserted by another commentator, Roy Lemoine, who wrote a book called The Anagogic Theory of Wittgenstein's Tractatus. And Lemoine says, the Tractatus is probably the most significant philosophical doctrine since the Critique of Pure Reason, that's high praise, from which it is in some ways derivative, but it is much harder to read. Even Wittgenstein, as he stated in his foreword, was aware that perhaps only those who had similar thoughts would understand him. It may be that my contribution to the study of the Tractatus comes from the fact that my own background is different from that of most scholars and has some similarity to Wittgenstein's. Lemoine says, I have been both a line officer and a chaplain, and I also served in a great war. And this experience that Lemoyne sort of marshals on his behalf is supposed to account for the fact that his book departs radically from traditional interpretations of the Tractatus. And if you read the first chapter of my book, you'll see that I actually do draw on some of Wittgenstein's experiences during the war, fighting in the war, to help interpret some of the puzzling passages near the end of the Tractatus. But anyway, Maslow and Lemoyne both sort of approach the Tractatus specifically as though it's an esoteric doctrine or document. When Wittgenstein returned to Cambridge in 1929 and began teaching in 1930, his classes were small and he published almost nothing save for the remarks on logical form. It may have seemed as though his students were insiders and his classes took on a reputation of being only for a select few. This secretive reputation seems well captured by the account in Alan Turing's biography of how Turing got into Wittgenstein's class in 1939. Turing, you might remember, is a sort of forefather of the computer. He was a logician with philosophical interest at Cambridge in the 1930s, and he was somewhat interested in Wittgenstein's view because Wittgenstein was going to lecture about the foundations of mathematics, which was Turing's field. So Turing wanted to go to Wittgenstein's lectures in 1939. He did. His biographer, Andrew Hodges, recounts the experience as follows. There were about 15 in the class, and each had to go first for a private interview with Wittgenstein in his austere Trinity room. These interviews were renowned for their long and impressive silences, for Wittgenstein despised the making of polite conversation. After they had talked about some logic, Wittgenstein said he would have to go into a nearby room to think over what he had said. So Hodges is trying to, or is conveying the idea that Wittgenstein's classes were sort of esoteric, just for the select few. I wrote to Hodges to ask him what his source for this information was, and he thought probably Robin Gandy, who had been a friend of Turing's, but Gandy's been dead for a number of years, and Hodges didn't have any more information, so I couldn't track down what he had offered, what he had proposed here, because it didn't ring true to me. I don't accept the implicit suggestion that Wittgenstein only allowed certain people into his classes. His courses were almost always publicly announced in the Cambridge Reporter. The only exception of which I am aware was classes in Lent term of 1938. That was right after he had been staying in Schkolden from the fall of 36 all the way through the fall of 37 up until about November. And then he went back to Cambridge in December and January and apparently offered some at least informal classes starting in January. This would have been the Lent term of 1938. And Theodore Redpath, who was one of his students then, reports Wittgenstein had started lecturing that week but didn't want too many people to come. And so the lectures were not open lectures, but for people Wittgenstein had decided on to attend if they wished. And then there was also the famous case of the Blue Book, which was dictated to a select group of students in 1933 to 1934 from a canceled class for mathematicians that had grown too large. I don't know if they'd go for this in the university now, for me saying, I'm offering this class, but there are too many people here, so I'm going to cancel the class. Wittgenstein said, you, and you, come with me. I'll dictate my ideas to you, and then you can share them with the class later on. I think people could get away with that a long time ago. Anyway, two announcements for his classes. Actually, the first class that he ever taught in Lent term of 1930, and then a class in Michaelmas term 1931, a little bit later. In the Cambridge Reporter, the Cambridge Reporter is basically the university newsletter that let people know what courses were being offered and so forth. And for both of these courses there, the reporter noted that the times were to be arranged to suit the convenience of students who are requested to call upon Dr. Wittgenstein at a time specified, at a place and time specified in the reporter before the start of term. Now, this conceivably could have been the mysterious private interview that Hodges was referring to for Turing, but to me it sounds more like a mere formality to facilitate scheduling. The only requirement that I am aware of that Wittgenstein placed upon students attending his classes was that they attend for the whole term. And he emphasized this in a letter 1939 to Georg Hendrik. Well, in the United States we always call him von Wright, but I guess von Fricht was perhaps how he pronounced it. But Wittgenstein emphasized that he did not want casual visitors. He only wanted people who would be there for the whole semester. But beyond that, as far as I know, he never placed any restrictions on who could attend his classes. Norman Malcolm does mention that Morris Lazarowitz had sought permission from Wittgenstein to attend his lectures in 1947 and 1948, and Wittgenstein had written back to grant his permission, though in the end, Wittgenstein didn't teach that class because he retired before then, which apparently caused Lazarowitz great grief. But anyway, perhaps such permission was appropriate for non-students, but there's no reason to suppose that Wittgenstein granted or withheld permission selectively. As Gasking and Jackson wrote about Wittgenstein's lectures, anyone was welcome who seriously wanted to learn philosophy and not just to hear Wittgenstein's. So even though Wittgenstein's classes may have had a reputation for being just for insiders and maybe esoteric, the point I'm trying to make here is that they were not like that. They were announced, they were open. If people felt the need to seek permission, he granted permission. The only requirement was that they stay for the whole semester. So in the classes that he taught, there was no sort of limitation on who could be there. While the classes Wittgenstein taught were not large, he did teach at least one class each term, beginning in Lent 1930 and ongoing through Easter term of 1936. And then he was in Schulden for a year and a half. And then again from Lent 1938 through Michaelmas 1941. And then he had a reduced schedule of teaching from Lent 1942 through Lent 1943. Then he was not teaching at all for a little over a year when he was working during World War II. And then again, finally, when he returned to Cambridge and taught a full schedule from Michaelmas 1944 through Easter 1947. So this is more than two dozen classes. These classes tended to have over a dozen attendees. And as far as I can tell, the attendees were self-selected, not selected by Wittgenstein. This is an important fact, because it means that Wittgenstein was addressing people that he had not chosen. It is also important that Wittgenstein's classes were primarily discussions. They were sometimes announced as lecture and conversation classes, and sometimes simply as conversation or informal discussions. Although the discussions were often actually monologues, the reality is that Wittgenstein was faced with regular feedback, either in the form of questions or unanswered questions from him, or the silence of incomprehension. In any case, Wittgenstein learned how attendees responded or failed to respond to his thoughts. This put him in a very different situation from the one he imagined in the draft foreword quoted previously. Far from writing for the small circle of cultural friends scattered around Europe, as he did in 1930, he was now faced with dozens of students, term after term, who were foreign to him. They fell into the category of, you know, the prevailing spirit of European and American civilization who were coming to his classes. He came to know how these others thought and how that affected the issues he wanted to address. He began to identify those thought patterns that ran contrary to his own, or at any rate to those he preferred, and he began to address them. He would no longer proceed esoterically. So this is the point I'm trying to make, is that up until about 1930, he wrote and he saw himself as writing for a sort of select audience. But from the time that he started teaching and addressing students who, you know, were not selected by him, he had to change his mode of operation. This transformation is a conjecture on my part, and the evidence I have marshaled is somewhat limited. For example, in notes by lectures by students from his lectures, it is not until the Easter term of 1931 that he mentions being tempted or resignation of temperament, resignation of one's temperament. These are, if you're familiar with the philosophical investigations, this kind of terminology runs wild with investigations of being tempted and so forth, describing how people want to think about certain issues. But what I'm saying is that in the early lecture notes, when he first started lecturing, this kind of terminology was not in his vocabulary, really. He wasn't interested in these kinds of issues. Then in 1932, so this is about 2 years into his teaching, mentions of temptation and other kinds of non-cognitive factors become increasingly common. What Wittgenstein is doing is beginning to appreciate and engage with differing attitudes. Exactly how and where this transformation can be evidenced is research that I have not done, but that there was such a transformation is clear to me anyway. The Philosophical Remarks, which is a manuscript from 1930, to which a later version of the above-quoted foreword was attached, hardly even alludes to issues of temperament or temptation. Wittgenstein only once mentions in the Philosophical Remarks that what we are tempted to say, and there are perhaps half a dozen other such comments in the Philosophical Remarks. Josef Rothhaupt, a researcher on Wittgenstein, who has paid a lot of attention to this foreword, argues, however, that these prefatory remarks, the ones that I was quoting earlier in the paper, Rothhaupt has argued that they weren't even intended for the Philosophical Remarks, that they were just pasted onto that by Rush Rees, who edited that material. But even so, Rothhaupt says that that foreword was intended for something that Wittgenstein called, or that Rothhaupt calls the Kringelbuch, which is a set of remarks that have a special little squiggle next to them. But if you look at all of those remarks, none of them use the word temptation or tempted or any of this kind of non-cognitive terminology. So what I'm conjecturing is that the writing that Wittgenstein was doing in the early 1930s, very early 1930s, doesn't deal with these kind of non-cognitive phenomena, and that's signaled to us by this foreword that I quoted from extensively. But then this kind of non-cognitive attention to what tempts us and our temptations and so forth starts appearing in his writings after he's been lecturing for a while. When Wittgenstein comes to write the foreword for the Philosophical Investigations in 1945, he is explicitly no longer writing for the select few that think like he does about his thoughts. There, Wittgenstein writes in the preface to the Investigations, "I make them public with misgivings. It is not impossible that it should fall to the lot of this work in its poverty and in the darkness of this time to bring light into one brain or another, but of course it is not likely." Wittgenstein's very pessimistic about how successful he might be, but his aim now is clearly to engage ways of thinking different from his own. So it is that in part one of the Philosophical Investigations, Wittgenstein provides us with a running commentary of well over 100 examples on what produces the philosophical confusions we get into and what the problems are with appreciating his resolutions. So I did a survey of part one of the Philosophical Investigations, and it shows that philosophical problems arise or remain because of, and here I'll just read you, I put this in my book also, but 14 times in part one, phrases like these occur. What forces itself on us, what holds us captive, demands an answer, what must be, what leads us, what we can't help, or what no one would say. Things like that come up 14 times. 19 times, things like what we are tempted or seduced or bewitched or dazzled by. 7 times he mentions what suggests itself, strikes us, occurs to us, or impressions that we are under. Twice he talks about how things look to us. 8 times he talks about what we find surprising or convincing or senseless or ludicrous or sensible or matter of course. 28 times he talks about our compulsions or needs, urges, wants, tendencies, inclinations, expectations, or prejudices. 14 times he talks about what we notice, can get ourselves to think, can be satisfied with, only think of, overlook, don't realize, fail to see, or forget. 6 times he talks about what we would like. 6 times he talks about what we are committed to, or choose, or decide, or allow, or refuse. And 5 times he talks about how we look at or how we represent things. Now, all of this terminology in the Philosophical Investigations is addressing what I was calling non-cognitive factors, things in us that get us to, you know, think certain ways or not think certain ways. And the Philosophical Investigations then is overwhelmingly attending to how to address these, how to try and overcome them or refocus them or something like that. So these non-cognitive tendencies in us can apply to a great variety of issues, leading to many different philosophical problems. The sum of these tendencies could be said to constitute a temperament or a spirit of the times. And this very much connects back with my book, which is that Wittgenstein sees himself often as addressing people who are very different from him, with a temperament very different from his, with a time whose spirit is very different from his. And I conjecture that it was Wittgenstein's teaching in the 1930s that brought him to face and engage these differences and led him to try to address them. He would no longer approach things esoterically. Instead, he was trying to figure out how to bring about the changes needed to appreciate a different way of viewing philosophical issues. And so, Wittgenstein had become an evangelist. Okay, so I'm claiming he's an esotericist up until the early 1930s. Then he starts teaching, and this then confronts him with all the difficulty in getting people to see how he approaches things. And he takes that on then as his task, and I'm calling this the evangelistic task, which then certainly has full flower, you might say, in the philosophical investigations. Oddly enough, Karl Popper accused Wittgenstein of cultivating esotericism, is the term he used. I think esotericism maybe is a little bit more familiar, but Popper called it esotericism. In his famous 1946 talk at Cambridge. So if you know anything about Wittgenstein at all, you know about the famous confrontation between Wittgenstein and Popper in 1946 when Popper came to give a talk and he attacked Wittgenstein's way of doing philosophy, and Wittgenstein supposedly took a poker out of the fireplace and was allegedly brandishing it at Popper, and Wittgenstein marched out. Anyway, this got a whole lot of notoriety. But not so much notoriety about what was actually said at that event. And so Alois mentioned public and private occasions. I quote the minutes that were taken by the person who was charged with taking minutes at that meeting as to what went on. And we also have a little bit of other information, too. There was another student there who took his own notes. We've put those in this collection. And also, Popper himself had some notes that he prepared. And also, Popper wrote to Bertrand Russell afterward about the event, because Russell was there. So actually, we know a fair bit about what went on. What Popper meant by accusing Wittgenstein of esotericism is a little bit unclear. What he meant is clarified somewhat in a letter to Bertrand Russell, who was also at the meeting, written shortly after the meeting. In this letter of October 27th, Popper wrote, "Philosophical activity in Wittgenstein's sense is not exoterically arguable. It cannot and does not consist of more than clever guesses about various intended meanings. It leads to a series of he may have meant, da 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 da, but it does not lead to any assertion which can be open to argument. This fact completely destroys any link with the rationalist tradition in philosophy and must lead to esotericity." Now, I'm not exactly sure what evidence Popper was drawing on, but it probably does have to do with the sort of reputation that, I mean, we call them now Wittgensteinians. I don't know if you've heard that term, but Wittgensteinians have a reputation for, you know, for one thing, only studying Wittgenstein, and secondly, being absolutely certain that anything he said must be right, and furthermore, being impossible to discuss anything with because, you know, they just call any other viewpoint nonsense. Well, I mean, if there are such, I'm not such a person, by the way, but if there are such people, I guess you might call them esoteric in the sense that they don't really engage with anything, anyone outside their own small circle. And perhaps that's what Popper had in mind. It's hard to know, but given that none of Wittgenstein's later works had been published in 1946, it's not clear what he was drawing on. I think I might skip a little of this just in the interest of time, but I think I kind of gave you a sense of what he might have been thinking. Anyway, apparently what Wittgenstein, so part of Popper's problem was that Wittgenstein hadn't published anything, and so Popper had to go by rumor in 1946 as to how Wittgenstein proceeded. I guess it sort of feeds into the esoteric reputation if he only teaches small classes, if you think those classes have to be, you know, have to have permission to attend them, and Wittgenstein doesn't publish anything, then it might seem as though this is a big esoteric operation. But apparently what kept Wittgenstein from publishing was the very sense that he had not yet found the best or most effective way to engage with those who might disagree with him. As Wittgenstein put it in his 1933 letter to the editor of Mind, renouncing Braithwaite's attempted summary of his views, that which is retarding the publication of my work, the difficulty of presenting it in a clear and coherent form, a fortiori prevents me from stating my views within the space of a letter. So he says, you know, wait, you'll see. The fact that he had still not published anything 13 years after that might have provoked Popper to suspect that he had no intention of sharing his views publicly. But in fact, as of 1945, when Wittgenstein wrote the preface to the Philosophical Investigations, Wittgenstein was still hard at work trying to publish something that would engage with those who did not share his preferred ways of thinking. He was trying to be an evangelist. He was still trying to figure out how to evangelize. And the preface to the Investigations, dated 1945, makes it clear that he wished to publish his work precisely because versions of his ideas, variously misunderstood, more or less mangled or watered down, were in circulation. Of course, the term evangelism has religious connotations, which I do not mean to invoke here. But the term still seems to me to be appropriate, because what Wittgenstein intended to bring about was not simply a change in beliefs. He saw that the changes needed to go more deeply. In the opening lines of his chapter called Philosophy in the so-called Big Typescript, which was compiled by him in 1933, Wittgenstein wrote, "The difficulty of philosophy is not the difficulty of the sciences, but the difficulty of a change of attitude. Resistances of the will must be overcome. As I have often said, philosophy does not lead me to any renunciation, since I do not abstain from saying something, but rather abandon a certain combination of words as senseless. In another sense, however, philosophy requires a resignation, but one of feeling and not of intellect, and maybe that is what makes it so difficult for many." What he has, as I quoted here, what he has often said can't refer to anything except the lectures he's been giving. And the many for whom he's just said it's so difficult can only be his students. So what I'm saying here is that in this passage in the Big Typescript, so this is 1933, he's already himself specifically saying that he's had to say this over and over, obviously to his students, and they have difficulty hearing it. It seems clear he's referring to his students. And in Lee's notes of Wittgenstein's lectures in Easter of 1931, we do find the line, "Doing philosophy may perhaps mean resignation of temperament, but never of intellect." So that's one of the times he had said this, I guess. His goal then in the Investigations is to see how we might bring this resignation about. Since his goal was articulated by him in the 1930 draft as pertaining to the sort of spirit one has, it seems appropriate to use a term like evangelism after all. One of Wittgenstein's students in 1938, James Taylor, went on to graduate school in philosophy at the University of California at Berkeley. They corresponded, and in one of his letters back to Wittgenstein reporting on the department, he wrote, "I haven't done any missionary work yet." This would seem to imply that there was a sort of common sense that something could now be accomplished, though surely the term missionary was a jest, whether it originated from Wittgenstein or from Taylor. But the term missionary does clearly convey a sense of being among those who are quite different in important ways and wanting to do something about it. Okay, now I'll have to compress the last part, but what I want to do is talk about another transition that's important. It takes place in the mid-1940s when Wittgenstein decides to stop teaching. And he says a lot about his attitude about things around this time. And so I want to quote some of these and connect this with another transition back to perhaps esotericism. During the so he stopped teaching at the end of the spring term of 1947. That was the last term that he taught. During the break before Easter term 1947, what would turn out to be his last term teaching, Wittgenstein reflected on the difficulty of trying to change people's philosophical views by writing or arguing. This is in Culture and Value. "It is as though I wanted to change men's and women's fashions by talking." Perhaps recalling his 1931 strategy to deal with common philosophical problems by erecting signposts to help people pass the danger points, he now reflects, "My warnings are like the posters at the ticket offices at English railway stations. Is your journey really necessary?" As if anyone reading that would say to themselves, on second thought, no. The philosopher says, look at things like this, but first, that's not to say that people will look at things like this. Secondly, he may be altogether too late with his admonition, and it's possible, too, that such an admonition can achieve absolutely nothing, and that the impulse toward such a change in the way things are perceived must come from another direction. The diagnosis he proposes sounds positively political. It is not by any means clear to me that I wish for a continuation of my work by others, more than a change in the way we live, making these questions all superfluous. Wittgenstein finally quit teaching in 1947. He explained his resignation to Bousma as necessary to finish his book, but also as a result of pessimism about his role as a teacher. He told Drury in 1949, "My thinking is not wanted in this present age. I have to swim so strongly against the tide. Perhaps in 100 years people will really want what I'm writing." And in yet another prefatory comment from 1948, he wrote, "With repugnance I hand over the book to the public. The hands in which it will fall are mostly not the ones in which I like to imagine it. May it, I wish, soon be entirely forgotten by the philosophical journalists, and thus perhaps remain preserved for a better kind of reader." Here we find him jettisoning his evangelism and returning to esotericism. His audience is not the public or the philosophical journalist, but a better kind of reader who presumably understands what he's up to. He awaits a change in the way we live, making all these questions superfluous. In my book, in chapter 8, I trace the evolution of Wittgenstein's thought on a certain issue concerning the relationship between physiological phenomena and mental phenomena, basically the relationship between the brain and the mind. And I claim there that this change in purpose from evangelical back to esoteric helps to explain what he says there. And I'm not going to go into that here. But again, I consider research on this issue to be very preliminary. My conjecture is that the writing he did once he lost faith in and gave up his teaching may show a move away from addressing the non-cognitive aspects of temperament as they bear on philosophical puzzles. So my answer to the question posed in the title of this paper, Wittgenstein, esotericist or evangelist, is both. First one, then the other, then the first again. If I'm right about the transitions I have outlined, then this would provide a basis for a different way of talking about stages in Wittgenstein's philosophy. Initially, people distinguish between an early and later Wittgenstein based on the differences of method and substance in the Tractatus, on the one hand, early, and the Philosophical Investigations, late. That approach has been criticized from two directions, some people adding a third Wittgenstein, or even a fourth Wittgenstein, in the middle period or in the much later period, or other people saying, there really isn't any difference between the early and the later. So, these stages have been criticized from both directions. The grounds for making or denying stages, though, have always been somewhat unclear and indeed variable. My suggestion is not wholly separate from these earlier stages, but asks us to focus on who Wittgenstein takes himself to be addressing and how, and what he's trying to accomplish. From this point of view, the Tractatus and the work of the early 1930s is esoteric. The work from about 1932 or so becomes evangelical until he loses confidence in his approach before or around the time he quit teaching in 1947, and then again becomes esoteric. These stages do not involve sharp dividing lines, nor do they fit with the previous maps of the stages, but they do focus attention on issues of importance to us and to Wittgenstein, and in particular, they draw on Wittgenstein's own ways of characterizing what he was doing. Finally, they offer an agenda for looking into Wittgenstein's work in ways that have not so far received much attention. In that respect, I hope that this may be a fruitful idea for future work. One of the implications of my stages is that what is most familiar to us in Wittgenstein's later philosophy, especially part one of the investigations, falls squarely into the evangelical stage. While this is a new term of description, it helps to focus our attention on what Wittgenstein was trying to do and how he was trying to do it. I think it is important to see that Wittgenstein took evangelism seriously, even while he did not see how to succeed and eventually admitted failure. This is important because proponents of Wittgenstein's views too often proceed as though his views and arguments should take hold just as a result of being presented, or being presented forcefully enough, or being presented clearly enough, or loudly enough. I think all these things kind of characterize so-called Wittgensteinians. But that is not at all how Wittgenstein saw it. Wittgenstein writes, "Quite different artillery is needed here from anything I am in a position to muster. Most likely, I could still achieve an effect in that, above all, a whole lot of garbage is written in response to my stimulus, and that perhaps this provides a stimulus for something good. I ought always to hope only for the most indirect of influences," he said. Of course, we then would want to ask who it is that's writing the garbage. Perhaps that was all the Wittgensteinian publications. And then, what is the something good that may come from it? Something itself written? No, more likely something else. But what? Thank you.